Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European American and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal medicine, Mayank Seth. Thank you, Mayank. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi everybody and welcome to today's webinar. As you know, we're going to be talking about immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, or IMHA as most of us all know it. And I'm sure this is a disease that most of you as emergency vets will have some familiarity and experience with. But I also know it's a condition where there's a lot of controversy, a lot of confusion, and a lot of different opinions. So I'm going to try and make sense of some of that as we go through things and try and create a sort of rational approach and sort of talk through why I recommend treating IMHA the way that I do. So we're going to start off by briefly covering the pathophysiology of IMHA, then talk about some of the diagnostic criteria we can use to confirm that that's what's going on. And then we're going to spend a large part of the talk focusing on the treatment of IMHA. In particular, we're going to be talking about immunosuppressant strategies, but also talking a little bit about transfusion, and also spend some time talking about antithrombotic strategies, and the differences and the importance of those as well. And we'll put that all together at the end with a nice little summary of how I go about treating the average IMHA patient, if there is such a thing. And before I really start going into things, I just want to point out that there's been quite a lot of work done in this field over the last few years. And in particular, I wanted to draw your attention to a couple of things which are now available as freely downloadable articles, which you may well find useful. So the first two articles we have here are the ACVIM consensus statements, which have been published by the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine. So there's one of those on the diagnosis of IMHA, what criteria we use to make a diagnosis, what else we should look for concurrent with the diagnosis, and then they produced a second consensus statement on how their recommendations from an international panel on how we should treat IMHA. And then the third consensus guidelines I want to draw your attention to, again, freely downloadable, are the ACVEC, so American College of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care, consensus statements on the rational use of antithrombotic drugs. So they call these the curative guidelines. And they've got a little bit on IMHA, but also quite a lot on antithrombotics, how we should be using them, which ones to use when, how we should be monitoring them, and so on. And it's a useful resource for you to be aware of. So with that said, let's talk about IMHA. So if we think about what causes IMHA, it might start off with something like a foreign antigen or a source of inflammation somewhere, or potentially it's just destiny and bad luck for an individual dog or cat. And whatever it is, something acts on a T cell, and that causes that T cell to become activated, and in doing so produces IL-2. IL-2 in turn is going to cause stimulation of a corresponding B cell, and that B cell is then going to clonally multiply and become activated too. And in doing so, it's then going to produce antibodies. So here we have an IgG molecule and an IgM molecule there. Those in turn are then going to potentially adhere to our red blood cell. And when they adhere to our red blood cell, one of a couple of things could happen. That could then lead to the recruitment of a macrophage, which then takes that red blood cell out of circulation. Or the other thing that might happen is that an antibody leads to the formation of a complement membrane attack complex on the surface of that red cell, causing lysis of that cell to occur in vascular space. So if we think about IMHA, there's lots of subtleties and nuances there, but broadly speaking, we can divide it into sort of two big categories of what we typically see in disease. The most common thing we see is this IgG-mediated disease. So these are these cases where we have IgG, this two binding site antibody, which binds to red cells, and as such, it's associated with some agglutination, not a lot, but there can be autoagglutination seen as part of that. And IgG primarily works in conjunction with things like macrophages in order to result in phagocytosis of red cells. So what we see is extravascular hemolysis. And that manifests itself as the development of icterus, and correspondingly, we can see bilirubinuria as well. And that, in human medicine at least, is thought to be a disease process which primarily takes place within the spleen. What we see less commonly, thankfully, is IgM-mediated disease. So this is where we have these pentameric antibodies with 10 binding sites across five different antibody molecules which are bound together, and that causes really quite marked autoagglutination. And this is a more primitive antibody which is associated with the complement cascade far more. So this is then when we tend to get intravascular hemolysis occurring, and so that's when we then get evidence of hemolysis of our plasma. So we get hemoglobinemia, and we get hemoglobinuria occurring as part of that as well. And again, in people, that's thought to be something which primarily takes place in the liver. And this is something that we would consider to be really bad news. It generally carries a much worse prognosis for it compared to IgG-mediated disease and those sorts of clinical manifestations. So, having talked about what actually drives IMHA, how do we drive it? Well, the clue is very much in the name. It's an immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. So the first part of that is to say that our patient should be anemic. So depending on your reference range, we're probably talking about a PCV of somewhere less than around 35%. I think we can all be fairly comfortable and confident with how we would diagnose that part of it. The next thing that we would like to see, although it's not necessarily mandatory and it's not a requirement per the consensus guidelines I just mentioned, is seeing evidence of hemolysis. So this might be that we see bilirubin or hemoglobin in the plasma or in the urine, so pigmenturia, pigmentemia. We should have a patient that's normovolemic, so it doesn't look like it's losing blood, it's not hemorrhaging, and yet it's becoming anemic, and that anemia should still be regenerative, although it should be noted that up to around 30% of patients with IMHA may have a non-regenerative form of IMHA. So again, these are things which can reassure us we're dealing with a hemolytic anemia, but they're not necessarily mandatory parts of the diagnostic criteria. What is really mandatory, though, is to say that we have evidence of immune-mediated disease, and this is the bit which can be a bit of a challenge and where people can sometimes fall foul. So, if we talk about how we identify immune-mediated disease, I want to start off by introducing you to a concept called the zeta potential. So, red cells normally have a negative charge on their lipid membrane surface, and that leads them to repel from one another, meaning that if you put them in a suspension, they're not going to stick together, they're going to go as far apart from each other as they can. Hence, blood is usually fairly homogeneously red. And what we all know we're looking for in IMHA is evidence of autoagglutination. So here we have those IgM molecules with their multiple binding sites, and we can see that it's very easy for these to result in red cells sticking to one another so that they move to red C when we see autoagglutination. The problem is that if we lose the zeta potential, as we can do for a variety of reasons with various metabolic and acid-base disturbances that lead to a change in the charge on the surface of red cells, uremia in cats being a common example here, then that can lead to cells not repelling each other as they normally would, and then their lipids stick together, and you can get some movement of cells in a cohesive group without there being antibodies involved, and this can very much look like autoagglutination. The other thing that can happen, FIP, multiple myeloma, and so on, in conditions where we have a hyperglobulinemia, then you can get what's called nonspecific adsorbance. So, despite the fact that there's not an antibody which specifically is binding to the red cells and targeting the red cells, just by the sheer amount of protein and so on that's around the place, some of it will end up sticking to red cells and causing those to loosely adhere to one another and move around as a cohesive unit again. And again, this can look like agglutination. So when we see this and we put a drop of blood on a slide and we get these sort of little spatterings stuck together, is that truly autoagglutination, or is that one of these other phenomena that I've just mentioned to you? Well, The way that we can, there's a few different ways that we can make that assertion. The gold standard is to do what we call a washing of red cells. So this is where we'd centrifuge them, resuspend them in saline, centrifuge them again, resuspend them again, and do that 3 times in order to remove the plasma, restore a normal acid-base environment around the cells, and so on, and see if the cells still stick to each other. But that's quite a cumbersome thing to do. The other thing we can do is we can just dilute the blood with saline. And in order to get something which is reasonably specific, we should dilute it at least 1 in 4 is the recommendations based on the literature that's out there. So 1 drop of blood, 4 drops of saline. And that's going to result in a really dilute looking sample where it can be quite difficult grossly to judge if it's agglutinating or not. So then you want to look at it down the microscope. And when we look down the microscope, if you just get a wet prep, so you take your drops of blood and saline and you put them on a microscope without any drying or fixing or staining or anything like that, then if you have autoagglutination, what you'll see down the microscope is these large clumps of cells that sort of float around in the water, and you can see them moving together with a few individual cells in the background. What you want to distinguish that from is something like this. So this is our classic rouleau formation where we have the cells just kind of stacked up on top of each other rather than in these big clumps and islands and so on. So this is suggestive of IMHA, this is not. But we've said that IgM-mediated disease where we see true autoagglutination is only actually present in a minority of cases. So if you're doing this rigorously with a high specificity, oftentimes you won't see autoagglutination. That's where Coombs testing potentially comes in. So what we'll often have is this situation here where we have one antibody bound to one red cell, another antibody bound to another red cell, but they're not actually adhered to each other, so they don't necessarily float around together. Well, what we can do with this is we could add Coombs reagent, which is an anti-antibody antibody. And by adding Coombs reagent to our mixture, then what that's going to result in is these red cells now sticking to one another by virtue of these antibodies sticking to these antibodies. So this will result in red cells clumping together and agglutinating, but only if there is antibody that's bound to the red cells in the first place. So the Coombs test is a way of demonstrating that you have non-agglutinating antibodies which are stuck onto red cells as a way of proving or that you have immune targeting of those red cells. The third way we can demonstrate the presence of immune targeting is through identification of spherocytosis. So the idea of spherocytosis is if we have our macrophage here represented by Pac-Man and it attempts to phagocytose a red cell, but it doesn't quite manage to get the whole thing, it might just take a little bit of that lipid membrane away. And when it takes a bit of that lipid membrane away, it changes the surface area to volume ratio of the cell such that it can no longer form its normal bidiscoid shape. And as such, it'll condense down into a sphere. When we look at that on the microscope, what we see is these little cells here that lack their normal central pallor. But the important point to note about this is that these spherocytes still just make up the minority of cells on the smear. If you look around, then the majority of cells still do have their central pallor. And this is what we would normally see with IMHA. It's important to make sure that most of the cells do have their central pallor because if they don't, it probably actually to ref just reflects a badly made blood smear or you looking in the wrong type area of a blood smear. Because it's certainly possible to get cells which lack their central pallor by looking in a thick part of a smear or just a badly made smear where every single cell will look like that. The important thing when we're looking for spherocytosis is we're looking at an appropriately made smear, and then it should only ever be 10 to 30% of the cells at most, which are actually spherocytes. The rest of them should still appear normal, and then you can be confident it's a genuine finding. So they're the three things we can use to identify immune targeting. We can look for autoagglutination, we can look for Coombs positivity, or we can look for spherocytosis. There are some other things that we might see on a CBC that can clue us into the presence of a hemolytic anemia. So if we think about what we get on a CBC, which Which tells us about red cells, we get an awful lot of parameters as listed here, which are all supposed to be information about our red cells. And all of these ones which I've circled in red now are things which can potentially be deranged as a result of IMHA. To talk to you a little bit about that, if we start by thinking about how CBC is generated in the first place, then what will generally happen is we'll have some sort of sensor, as represented by these blocks here. And this could be an electrical sensor, it could be a light-based sensor, depends on the type of machine that you're using, but there will be some sort of sensor. And on one side of it will be blood, which we have here with our red cells and our platelets, and this is oftentimes diluted before it goes through the sensor. But then liquid is drawn through the sensor, and as the cells are drawn through one by one, it measures the size of them and as well as counting how many go through. And then it hemolyzes those cells once they get onto the other side of the sensor, and it measures how red the liquid turns when we do that, and that's a measure of our hemoglobin concentration there. So if we look at what that actually translates to, then what happens is that our machine will produce a histogram that looks like this. So we've got a few cells here which are quite small, and then a bunch of cells here which are quite big. And all the cells on this side of things here are going to be what the machine counts as platelets. All the cells on this side of things here is going to be what the machine counts as red blood cells. And then our MCV is going to be the median concentration, or the mean concentration, rather the mean size, sorry, of the cells for this curve here. And our RDW is the total width of this curve here. So it's the range of different sizes of cells that it's counting as red cells. So let's have a think about what happens if we have autoagglutination in a sample. If we've got autoagglutination like this, then you can see that as this goes through the sensor as a single cell, it's now going to count one large cell where it should have counted four small cells. So the total number of cells it counts is going to go down. Our RBC goes down, but the average size of those cells in the mind of the machine goes up. So our MCV goes up. Correspondingly, our RDW and MCH, the mean corpuscular hemoglobin concentration, also go up. But these are the things which make us go, well, there's something funky going on there. If we have a sample that's hemolyzed because of intravascular hemolysis or because of fragility of the cells in our sample, then what's going to happen is we've got red on this side of the sample before it's gone through the machine and been hemolyzed. And that means there's going to be less cells than there should be on this side of the sample as well. So as a result of that, our RBC and our hematocrit go down. But the real telltale thing here, and the most pathognomonic thing you can see on a CBC, is this MCHC goes up. So the MCHC is the average amount of hemoglobin per cell. And if there's more hemoglobin than there are cells, then the MCHC is going to go up. There is no way that a normal red cell can fit more hemoglobin into it than nature normally does. And so there is nothing in vivo that can cause an elevated MCHC as a genuine finding. If you ever see an elevated MCHC on a blood on a hematology sample, then what that tells you with absolute certainty is that there is hemolysis that has occurred. And that might have occurred in vivo, it might have occurred during sampling, or it might have occurred in the tube after you collected the sample. But a high MCHC is always, always, always indicative of hemolysis. So that's how we diagnose IMHA. We've got the demonstrated anemia, we've demonstrated that it's immune mediated, preferably we've demonstrated that it's hemolytic as well, although that's a little bit more of a grey area. Once we've diagnosed IMHA, we then need to decide if it's primary, and that's sometimes called autoimmune hemolytic anemia, or whether it's secondary. And secondary IMHA can happen in response to a whole bunch of different things, and this is laid out in much more detail in the consensus statement that I mentioned for you earlier. But things that have been at least tentatively implicated in the development of IMHA include recent vaccination, meaning within the last 2 months, exposure to one of a number of different drugs, and in theory, any drug can do this, but the ones we would commonly implicate would be sulfonamides and penicillins, amongst others. Potentially cancers of one description or another. So, in particular, we would worry about the round cell neoplasias like lymphoma can be a cause of IMHA. In theory, any inflammatory focus, so an abscess or something along that, a UTI, something along those lines, could cause IMHA. It's actually been recently described in association with pregnancy in dogs, and that's a well-recognized thing in people as well. And then there are various I infections which have been specifically implicated in IMHA as well. So, mycoplasma, certainly in cats, Mycoplasma haemophilus has been strongly associated with IMHA. There are numerous other hemotrophic mycoplasmas in dogs and cats which may play a role, and it's worth considering those, particularly in immunocompromised or splenectomized animals. Depending on the travel history of the patient, then rickettsial and pyroplasms, so Babesia and such like, are potential causes of IMHA, and that has now been reported in at least one area of the UK to have babesiosis in dogs that have never travelled and abroad. But that seems to be in a very limited outbreak to one field in Essex, rather than being a wider problem at this time. And then Ehrlichia and Anaplasma, the evidence here is a lot more tentative. But again, Ehrlichia canis and Anaplasma phagocytophilum have both been described in dogs that haven't left the UK. So, not necessarily we're only looking at travel dogs. It's always worth considering these infections in dogs that haven't traveled as well. So, whenever we diagnose IMHA, just to go back to this slide, sorry, we want to think about all these other potential secondary causes and try and rule them out as best as we can before we come to a conclusion that our patient has primary IMHA. So we're going to do that mainly through our history, but also through considering diagnostic imaging. So getting chest X-rays, abdominal ultrasound, or a CT in order to look for evidence of neoplasia, in order to look for evidence of any other inflammatory foci. Potentially, depending on the history, depending on the other findings, we may want to consider doing some specific PCRs for some of these infections as well, but that's going to be on a case-by-case basis, deciding whether we want to do those. And if we don't find anything with any of that, then we come to the conclusion that our patient has primary IMHA. If we diagnose a patient with primary IMHA, then we then need to talk to the owners about what that means. And generally speaking, at this point, I'll give owners my rule of thirds. And this is a little bit pessimistic, but I'd always err towards being pessimistic when I'm talking to owners about this disease. So what I'll say to owners is, in about a third of the cases, we'll start treatment and we can manage your dog and monitor it on an outpatient basis, and it'll do just fine. And in a few months' time, we'll stop treatment and we'll forget this ever happened. In a third of cases, they can get through it and they can survive, but there are potentially going to be complications. There's going to be a requirement for transfusion. There might be organ failure. There might be thrombotic complications and things like that that require a period of hospitalization. But if we persist and we stick with it and we can get through all those complications, those dogs will also survive and go on usually to have fairly normal lives. And then what I tell owners is about a third of patients generally don't survive dogs with diagnosis of IMHA. And that's, let's say, a little bit pessimistic. The older literature talks about a 60% survival rate. The more recent literature talks about an 80 to 85% survival rate based on how we generally treat the disease these days. But as I say, I'd always rather be a little bit more negative with them so that we don't over egg their expectations. In terms of things we can use to guide our prognosis during that initial chat, then if we have this IgM-mediated intravascular hemolysis, strongly autoagglutinating disease, then that generally carries a worse prognosis. If there is a marked elevation of bilirubin, sort of getting up above like 60, 70, those sorts of numbers, then that again has been shown to be a negative prognostic indicator, as has an elevated urea, as has a reduction in platelet counts. So these are all things that would just make me be a little bit more cautious when talking to the owners about what to expect. Why do these patients die? Well, they unfortunately die for a number of different reasons, and one of the commonest ones that I unfortunately have to deal with is because of financial restrictions. So it's that the owners run out of money to be able to afford yet another blood transfusion. Or they run out of money to be able to continue to support their dog who's still recovering from its acute kidney injury and is going to take another couple of weeks maybe to get there and so on and so forth. And that's a harsh reality of this condition is that it can be very expensive to treat. But if we move aside from that to what else can actually get to them, anemia in my mind shouldn't really be a major cause of death, other than to say it is a financial restriction. Because in the majority of cases, when a patient becomes anemic, if there aren't financial restrictions, we can look to transfuse it and buy us some more time on that front. So, although it is a disease which primarily causes anemia, anemia is usually something we can temporarily overcome, at least. One of the reasons that patients may die then is as a result of side effects from some of the medications we'll use to treat the disease, as we'll come on to in a minute. Another one that we sometimes see is what's termed Kern icterus. So this is where the bilirubin levels get so high that patients get neurotoxicity and they seizure to death as a result of it. And we see this sometimes when bilirubin levels get generally above around 400 or so, in my experience. So we've got a patient which is getting anemic, it gets a blood transfusion, that buys it another day or two. It becomes anemic again, we give it enough blood transfusion, and so on and so forth. And all the time we're doing this, that hemolysis is leading to the bilirubin levels going up and up and up, even though we're keeping on top of the hematocrit. Once the bilirubin levels hit a certain point, the brain just can't cope with it, and it causes quite profound and quite sudden, oftentimes, a neurologic dysfunction. And say these patients can go into status epilepticus as a result of that. And then the other one, which we really worry about in these patients, is thromboembolism. And that can cause death through a variety of different mechanisms, acute kidney injury, potentially neurologic complications. But the commonest one we'd worry about here is pulmonary thromboembolism. So how do we treat IMHA? Well, if we've identified that it's secondary IMHA, then one of the most important things we can do is treat the underlying and concurrent diseases that we've identified. As I've already briefly mentioned, if we've got anemia, we can give transfusions. And then really the main things we want to think about are immunosuppressants and antithrombotics. It used to be very en vogue to talk about giving you gastroprotectants concurrently in these cases as well, so omeprazole or such like, but there really isn't much evidence for doing so, even with high doses of steroids and so on. And actually, there is a growing body of evidence to suggest that the prophylactic use of gastroprotectants in these cases may be doing more harm than good. And then again, depending on where you are in the world and what your suspicions are, doxycycline is often something that will be used, at least in the initial part of the treatment of these patients, because to definitively diagnose or rule out Mycoplasma, Ehrlichia, some of the small Babesias, and so on, could take a number of days. And if you're in an area where these conditions are of high prevalence, it's worth considering prophylactic treatment for them while you're awaiting definitive diagnosis, but not so much in the UK. Just a brief word on transfusions, to say that they're absolutely 100% life-saving in dogs with IMA, dogs or cats with IMHA that are becoming profoundly anemic. They need blood quickly, and oftentimes our other strategies to treat the disease do not result in a rapid increase in hematocrit. So a lot of these patients really do need blood transfusions. But blood transfusions in IMHA are problematic for a couple of reasons. The first is to say that we already have antibodies working against red cells present in the patient. And that can mean, as we get on to our second, third transfusions, and so on, that it can be really difficult to get meaningful cross matches and blood types and so on out of these patients in order to see what blood we should be giving them because of interference from those antibodies that are part of the underlying disease. And that can make it really quite challenging to know what unit of blood to use for the best in some of these patients, which do require multiple transfusions over longer periods of time. The other one, which is often talked about in IMHA, is whether giving blood transfusions to them is just fueling the fire. So we've got the immune system targeting red cells. If we give more red cells, aren't we just going to pile on the stimulus for the immune system to do more damage? And I can see the logic to that argument, but it's not one that I really buy in all honesty. I think that there is more than enough red cells and more than enough immune stimulation around for the immune system to be ramped up as high as it's going to go without worrying about what effects something as trivial as a transfusion has on top of that. Now, transfusions are by no means benign and they have lots of other side effects, which is a webinar in its own right. So I wouldn't advocate liberal transfusion of these patients. I would say that it should be done as needed based on clinical judgment. So if a patient is becoming weaker and more tachycardic and so on, then it needs a transfusion. If its PCV is lowish, but it's not tachycardic and it's not looking weak and symptomatic for its anemia, then I would maybe hold off until such a time as it is. It's something which really needs to be based on the individual patient and the individual circumstances, but I wouldn't hold back if the patient needs it. So moving on to the bit that I'm sure most of you are most interested in, let's talk about immunosuppressants in IMHA. And here we have a list of the immunosuppressant strategies that have been reported in the literature for the treatment of IMHA. There are a few others beside this that have been reported in an experimental settings, but here are the ones that have really made their way into the mainstream veterinary press. And as we look at those, we can say that there's a couple of those that we can already take off the table, because there have been good studies conducted with respect to the use of cyclophosphamide and danazol in dogs with IMHA, which have shown that not only are they not beneficial, but they are quite probably deleterious to our patients, and therefore we shouldn't be using them in these conditions. But everything else is still up for debate. So if we talk about first about the main drug we would use, prednisolone, or we talk about glucocorticoids more generally, then if we look back at our scheme of what's going on in terms of the pathophysiology of IMHA, steroids are a useful class of drug because they act on all of these different parts of the pathway here. So they prevent T cell activation, they prevent lymphocytes multiplication, they prevent B cell antibody production, they prevent phagocytosis of opsonized red cells, and they stabilize red cell membranes in order to reduce the activity of the complement attack complex. So you can see that there's lots of things that steroids do which are potentially of benefit. And in dogs, the main area of action is actually this one here. So they're working primarily on macrophages to reduce the rate of phagocytosis of red cells that occurs, which again we can see is a potentially very useful part of the treatment of IMHA. If we look at what some of the other drugs do, so azathioprine, mycophenolate, and leflunomide all essentially work on the same part of lymphocyte metabolism in that they block a specific part of purine synthesis and thereby they reduce lymphocyte metabolism and they reduce the ability of lymphocytes to proliferate. So they're going to work on these parts of the pathway that are highlighted in red up at the top of my screen there. If we think about cyclosporine, that has a even more targeted mechanism of action in that cyclosporine is a calcineurin inhibitor, and what it does is it blocks the pathway in T cell activation that leads to IL-2 production. So it's going to hopefully reduce the likelihood of T cells stimulating B cells and everything that comes downwind of that. So it's a very specific mode of action that goes with that drug. And then finally, the other one, which we'll talk about in a bit more in a bit more detail, but many of you will have heard of, is this drug called HIVIG or human intravenous immunoglobulin. So this is basically a concentrate of antibodies derived from human blood and plasma donations. And what HIVIG is purported to do in IMHA is a couple of things. The main mechanism of action is this part down here. It's what we call Fc receptor blockade. So the idea is that we're giving so many antibodies into the plasma of our patient that our macrophages are busy gobbling up the other antibodies rather than our antibody, which is bound to our red cell, and thereby reducing red cell phagocytosis. The other thing they do is they reduce the overall amount of production of antibodies by B cells because B cells recognize the presence of a hypergloblinemia, and they increase the clearance of antibodies by the liver as well. So a few potentially beneficial mechanisms of action for IVIG. So how do we actually use those drugs? Well, before we come on to how I recommend using them, I guess I want to define a couple of terms for you. The first of those is to talk about remission in IMHA. And I define remission as being when the PCV is no longer falling. And that's not the same as saying that we've stopped hemolysis. What that's saying is we have slowed down hemolysis to the point where the body is able to keep up production with that destruction, and our reticulocytes are the same or greater than the degree of hemolysis, so that the PCV either remains stable or may even be increasing. And that's then different from cure of the disease, which is where we've stopped hemolysis altogether, and preferably we're talking about a point in time where our patient no longer requires any therapy. If we go back to our scheme and think about those for a moment, then when we talk about remission, what I'm really talking about is reducing the rate of this part here. So we're reducing the rate of phagocytosis, we're reducing the rate of complement-mediated lysis. And that's different from cure, where we're aiming to stop these antibodies from having an effect or even being present at all in the first place. So in terms of my immunosuppressant strategy, I like to divide and think of it on that basis. In the short term, I've got a sick patient who's in the hospital in front of my eyes. I want to achieve remission. I'm not worried about cure at that point. I'm worried about remission and slowing down that hemolysis that's going on right there and then. And then the long term, what I want to be able to do is manage and maintain that remission in a home environment and aim for cure with an acceptable quality of life. So in the short term, in terms of what I generally do is I give these patients steroids. And I give them just steroids because I think that's the only part which is likely to make a difference to my short-term goal of achieving a remission. If I just go back for a second to this slide here to talk about it a little bit more, then it's well demonstrated that a month or more after a patient is diagnosed and treated for IMHA, usually when they're at home with a stable, maybe even a normal PCV, you can still detect these antibodies in circulation. So stopping these antibodies has very little to do with whether our patient comes out of the hospital or not. What controls whether our patient comes out of the hospital or not is whether we can stop the hemolysis, the bits represented in the red circle here, and of the drugs that we commonly have available to us in order to do that, the only one from the list I just gave you is steroids. So we give steroids and we give time. And I can't emphasize enough that time is really important in these patients. Because the average amount of time it takes to respond to treatment for IMHA, regardless of what paper and what treatment protocol you look at, is about 5 to 14 days. So about a 1 to 2 weeks. I would say 1 week in my experience is fairly average. And that's a long time to wait when your patient is becoming progressively anemic in front of your eyes and needing its second or its third blood transfusion, and the costs are going up, and it's still in the hospital, and the owners aren't seeing it, and you're telling them every day that you've got a sick dog here who you're worried about, and it has a third chance of dying, and so on. Waiting 1 week in that situation situation can be really nerve-wracking, and it's a test of everybody's patience. But that's how long it typically takes for a dog to respond to IMHA. And I'm a firm believer and advocate of saying that in that week, the only drug which is going to make a difference that you're likely to be giving is the steroids. But sometimes you can't wait. So sometimes the patient is getting so sick that you need to do something else. When can't you wait? Well, when there's really, really marked hemolysis and there's really marked hyperbilirubinemia. I've already mentioned that that puts your patient at risk of Kern icterus, this neurotoxicity that can occur in association with high bilirubin levels. The other thing we do need to worry about in a more pragmatic sense is our transfusion supply. So, we don't have limitless supplies of blood. No one does. The pet blood bank is frequently running out of blood or putting it on short supply notice and so on. And so if we're running out of blood, it's going into our patient faster than we can get hold of it. Or if we're worried that the patient might be about to develop Kern icterus, then we need to think of something else that we can do in the short term as well. Well, as I've said, what we need to do is target these parts of the pathway that down here in red. And unfortunately, most of the drugs we talked about, azathioprine, cyclosporine, mycophenolate, leflunomide, aren't going to do that. So we need to think of other ways we can do that as well. And possibly what may well turn out to be the gold standard way of doing that is plasmapheresis. So this is more widely used in the States these days at a number of universities, available at the Royal Vet College in England at the moment. I know, so there are some other centres in the UK that are likely to have it in the near future. But this is where we hook our patient up to a dialysis machine or some other form of extracorporeal therapeutic machine. There are a few different ways it can be done. And we basically take all the plasma out of our patient, which contains the antibodies, and we replace it with the plasma from healthy donors, which shouldn't contain red cell antibodies. And in doing so, we can very quickly and very effectively shut down hemolysis. Now, it's a very expensive, very limited available therapy. And there's really not much literature out there about it to support that it really works at the moment. But the people that do have it and use it swear by it. And as I say, it is becoming increasingly available. So I think it's going to be something we potentially see or hear more about in the future. The next thing that we can talk about is IVIG, and I'll mention that a bit more on the next couple of slides. And then the other thing which used to be done and is still done on occasion is splenectomy. So we think that a large amount of this phagocytosis is going on within the spleen. If we just remove the spleen, hopefully we'll slow down the rate of hemolysis that's going on. And that's a very reasonable thing to consider. But again, there's not much evidence or literature out there for it at the moment, but I know a couple of groups again are working on that. The final thing we can consider doing then is what I use the long-term drugs, so our azathioprine, cyclosporine, mycophenolate, and so on. But as I've already said, we're doing that more out of desperation than anything else because they're unlikely to have much of an impact over the time frame we're looking at. So just to talk about IMHA and IVIG a bit more. We recently conducted a multi-center study looking at the use of IVIG in dogs which were newly diagnosed with IMHA coming into referral hospitals in the southeast of England. And what we found is that if we used and another group in Tufts have done a similar study, albeit with a slightly different product at slightly different doses. If we combine the results of those two studies and look at it, then what we see is that if we give IVIG to patients when we diagnose IMHA, we can achieve a 93% remission rate, as opposed to if we use steroids alone, the remission rate's 86%. Now, unfortunately, those differences are quite small, and that means that they're not significant. Statistically significant, but I like to think that what that represents is that there is a small subset of dogs where IVIG is beneficial. And so, excuse me, And so I think what we can conclude from this is that in a lot of dogs, as I said, between around 60 and 80% of dogs are going to get better with steroids alone, and therefore to use IVIG, which is a very difficult to get hold of, very expensive drug in all of these patients, is not warranted. But there may be a subset of patients where they were going to die from the disease, where IVIG may be of benefit to them. It's just we're not very good yet at determining which patients they are in order to use it prospectively. We still think that IVIG may have a role as a rescue therapy in those cases which aren't going well. So if we look then at the consensus statement guidelines that I mentioned back in the first slide again, then in the treatment consensus statement, they produced this flow chart as an algorithm for how they recommend treating dogs with IMHA. And just to run through this very quickly, again, you can refer back to it in your own time. Then following on from a diagnosis, they recommend either starting steroids or starting steroids with another immunosuppressant drug if you've got a reason why you don't want to just use steroids. If you do just use steroids, and then if you get a response after 7 days, great, you can go on to long-term management. If you don't see a response after 7 days, then they recommend adding in another drug. If you still don't see a response after another 7 days, then they suggest you go back and they reevaluate whether you've really made the right diagnosis and you're treating it the right way. If that is the case, then they recommend giving IVIG. And if you still haven't seen a response, then they recommend either considering splenectomy or they recommend adding in a third agent. But they're really hesitant about adding in a third agent, as am I, because when you start adding three different immunosuppressants to each other, then the risk of opportunistic infections becomes much, much greater. So at some point, hopefully, you will achieve remission in your patient with IMHA, and then the goal is to maintain it, achieve a cure, and to avoid steroid-related side effects like this. We've all seen these big dogs who were on steroids for long periods of time, and they develop this profound muscle wasting, the PEPD, the nighttime accidents, and so on, that reduce the dog's quality of life, reduce the owner's quality of life. And that can be a major cause leading to the owners giving up and asking for euthanasia in some of these patients as well. So in the long-term management, that's where I feel the drugs that act up here have their place in order to try and suppress further antibody production. So that's our azathioprine, cyclosporine, mycophenolate, and potentially leflunomide. So how do I go about long-term management? Well, in cats or in dogs less than about 20 kilos, I'm generally comfortable using steroids alone in the treatment of those patients. However, in larger breed dogs, so greater than 20 kilos, or if steroids are contraindicated for some reason, so I've got a dog which is diabetic or something along those lines, then I'll add in something else. Similarly, if the patient's been on steroids and that hasn't worked, or this is the second time or third time that the patient's had IMHA and it's got recurrently relapsing disease, then I'll add in another agent. I tend to have a clinical preference for azathioprine for use in dogs and chlorambucil for use in cats, although I can't justify that. There's no good evidence saying that it's better than any of the other options that are out there. It's just the drugs that I personally am most familiar and most comfortable with using because I tend to find that they're reasonably efficacious and I think the side effects are generally more manageable than with some of the other drugs that are out there. And I'll initially use azathioprine or chlorambucil together with steroids. Longer term, then, what I'll do is I'll start my patients on steroids, initially 2 mg/kg per day, and I'll reduce that to 1.5, then to 1, then to half, then to quarter, and then to a quarter every other day. If I'm using steroids alone, I'll keep them at that dose, each dose, for around 3 or 4 weeks, before each dose reduction. I keep my patients hospitalized until I'm confident they're in remission and their PCV is stable rather than falling. And then once they're in remission, I'll send them home and check them back in 4 weeks to make sure that their PCV is doing okay and hopefully it's reached close to the normal range. If that's the case, then I'll do a dose reduction and then after after each dose reduction, I'll reduce the I'll check the PCV another 10 days to 2 weeks later, reducing the dose once every 4 weeks, rechecking the PCV about 10 days after each dose reduction to make sure it's not associated with any relapse. If I've used another drug, then I'll keep that other drug going for about 6 months in total, but I'll reduce the steroids more quickly. So I'll go through that same tapering regime, but I'll aim to reduce the steroid dose every 2 to 3 weeks rather than every 3 to 4 weeks, so that we can hopefully get those out of the system a bit quicker. If my patient relapses either during treatment or after a dose reduction or after discontinuation of therapy, then you need to increase the immunosuppression. If it happens after a dose reduction, then I'll usually just go back up to the last dose that was effective. And if that wasn't enough, then go back to the starting dose. If it happens after you've discontinued therapy at some point, then generally speaking, you have to go back to the starting dose. If the patient was already on a second aid, wasn't on a second agent the first time round, I'll add one in. Or if it was on a second agent and is still on one, then I'll conclude that that second agent wasn't effective and therefore it might need a different second agent next time round. And if a patient has relapsed, I'll generally leave the second agent, so the azathioprine or whichever the drug you're using, going long term, potentially lifelong. As I said, what I'll try and avoid doing is just adding more drugs on top of each other, because therein lies a path to opportunistic infections. So finally, just to briefly talk about thrombosis with IMHA. This is a major complication that occurs, and if you go looking for it by doing angiograms and so on, you can find it in more than 50% of dogs with IMHA. And in the studies in America, it's been reported to be a major cause of mortality. And the first study which really highlighted this and the importance of it was this one out of Cornell, published in 2006. And just to show you what we're looking at here we're looking at a Kaplan-Meier survival chart. So here is survival, and here is time here. So what you want is a disease where the line stays really high, because that means all your patients survive for a really long time. If the line drops really low, it means all your patients died really quickly. So the higher the line, the better. And the interesting thing about this retrospective study of dogs which were treated for IMHA at Cornell is if we look at these two highest lines, which are almost on top of each other all the way here, then the thing they have in common is that these dogs all got aspirin, whereas these dogs didn't get any anticoagulants and these dogs got heparin. So the conclusion that was found from this was that aspirin probably did a lot to save dogs' life with IMHA. So if we think about what we can do to prevent thrombosis in IMHA, then the first thing that was most commonly used is aspirin. It used to be used half a mg per kg once a day, but more recent studies have found that at that dose, it's just not effective in some dogs, and it doesn't really have any effect on their platelets. In order to get it to be consistently effective in dogs, you need to use doses up to 2 mg per kg Q12 hours. The unfortunate thing about doing that is that there seems to be a higher rate of gastrointestinal toxicity associated with doing so. So aspirin, generally speaking, in the guidelines is falling out of favor these days and is being superseded by clopidogrel, which is another antiplatelet drug, which is now generically available and therefore much cheaper than it used to be. And this is used at a loading dose of 10 mg per kg, and then as the first dose, and then 2 to 4 mg per kg once daily. As I said, it's got more consistent action on dog platelets than does aspirin, and seems to have less by risk of side effects. There's been no proven benefit to using clopidogrel, but the studies that have been done in IMHA have shown that it's at least equivalent and certainly not inferior to clopidogrel. But on a theoretical basis, and because of the side effects, we generally prefer it these days to using aspirin. Heparin is the other drug which has been commonly used in the treatment of IMHA. The problem with heparin is that the dosing requirements seem to vary hugely from dog to dog and can be anything from 50 to 400 units per kilo as the dose that's required. And unfortunately, it seems from various studies as well as if we use a fixed standard dose, and particularly an inappropriately low dose, as maybe was the case in that first Cornell study I showed you, then not only is it not effective, but it may actually be deleterious to our patients. The other thing which makes heparin use more challenging is that the best way of monitoring heparin is by using something called the active anti-factor 10A assay. And that's not an assay that's available in the UK. Samples need to be sent to America for it, which means it costs a lot of money and takes a lot of time to get those results back, which, when you're adjusting doses based on those results, is not particularly practical or useful. So heparin is something which is probably effective if it's done correctly, but it's just too much of a logistical hassle to make it something that we would use on a regular basis in most instances. And that's validated from this paper in America, where they did have ready access to the anti-10A assay, and they titrated heparin around that. And what they concluded from this study is that individually adjusted dosing heparin reduced the case fatality rate in dogs with IMHA when compared to dogs receiving a fixed low dose of heparin. So it does work, but it's just not practical for us to be using in the UK, unfortunately, on a regular basis. What we now have available, and maybe a better alternative to heparin, and is what the curative guidelines would probably have us using in the UK, is this drug here, rivaroxaban, which is also quite an affordable drug which is available in the UK now. And what this is a direct factor 10 inhibitor. So it works on the coagulation cascade, much as heparin does, which in theory at least is preferable to drugs that work on platelets in IMHA. So heparins and rivaroxaban have a theoretical advantage over the use of clopidogrel. The nice thing about rivaroxaban is that the dosing of it appears to be much more standardized than the dosing for heparin and doesn't require as much monitoring. So there's only been a couple of small studies which have come out on rivaroxaban use in dogs with IMHA, and the only conclusion they've been able to make so far is that it's safe and well tolerated. But in theory, at least, this may be where we're heading with the treatment of dogs with IMHA, and it's what the curative guidelines would recommend for use in the absence of being able to individually monitor and adjust heparin. And dose this is generally around 0.9 to 1 mg per kg. And I say it is quite an affordable drug at most dog sizes. So, in conclusion, of how I treat my patients with IMHA. In dogs, when they're inappetent and in the hospital in the first instance, I'll treat them with dexamethasone at 0.2 mg per kg per day. As soon as they're eating, I'll transition them on onto prednisolone, and I'll give that at 2 mg per kg per day and do that up to a maximum of 50 milligrams. So if a dog is greater than 25 kilos, I still don't feel comfortable giving it more than 50 milligrams. I'll generally speaking put it on rivaroxaban, and I'll do that for 1 month because that's the period where they're most at risk of thrombosis. And then if concurrently, I'll use azathioprine if I have a dog that's greater than 20 kilos, or if it's got a steroid contraindication, or there's relapsing disease. And the azathioprine dose I'd use is 2 mg per kg once daily for 2 weeks, then reduced to 2 mg per kg every other day. In cats, again, I'll start them on dexamethasone while they're inappetent, and switch them to prednisolone when they're eating, generally speaking at higher doses, so 2 to 4 mg per kg per day in the first instance. And if there's a reason why I do need to use a second agent in a cat, I'll use chlorambucil, and I'll generally use that at 2 milligrams every 2 to 3 days if steroid sparing is required. Thrombosis is not a common complication in cats, and therefore we don't typically use antithrombotics in them at the same time. So hopefully that's given you a summary of how I think about IMHA and how I go about treating it. But I'd be happy to take any questions if there are any.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Mayank for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.